Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to another Wednesday webinar. Today is May 3rd, 2023. And again, thanks for joining me. I don't think I have any announcements to make about anything that's going on. We've got a lot of exciting new products coming down the pipe. I think this week we're going to introduce a turpentine product, and soon there's going to be some of the best olive oil that I've ever eaten, and we'll probably do a podcast on that. So stay tuned, and there's a lot of good stuff coming down the pipe. So right before I got on the internet, well, after I got on the internet and checked my email, I saw a comment about a new Twitter, whatever you call it, Twitter thing from Dr. Robert Malone, who referenced that we need to stop this nonsense about there's no virus. And he was saying that there was some new information, I guess, from an institute in France, and I don't know the name of the institute, who has isolated the virus SARS-CoV-2, I think they said 10,000 times. And so that is definitive proof that the virus is real, has been isolated, and it's time to stop all this nonsense about no virus. So obviously there was an explosion of questions for Dr. Malone on the Twitter feed, I guess you call it, most of which I don't think he answered. Unfortunately, there was no link to the paper. So if anybody has that paper, if they could send it to me so I could take a look. And this brought up something that I was thinking about, because I've seen a couple interviews with different podcasters and different interviewers. I think one was somebody named Tim Truth, and then there was Germ Warfare. And the point I want to make is we're entering into a new phase, at least hopefully, of this conversation. And the new phase is we're having a difficult time arranging legitimate conversations with our detractors, we being the no virus team and the detractors being the pro virus team. It's hard to set up the conversation. It's hard to agree on the parameters of the conversation. It's just hard to organize this that makes any sense. So I think the people who need to really be in a position to ask the questions are the ordinary interviewers and podcasters and journalists, which is as it should be, because you should know enough about this if you're doing an interview, if you're writing a story, if you're a journalist, if you're a podcaster. It's your responsibility to know enough about this issue so that you can ask the proper questions and not be bamboozled by nonsense. So I thought, before I got into the DNA stuff, which is really what I want to do today, to give another approach that you might want to take specifically about this isolation issue. Because first of all, the isolation issue is everything. If you haven't isolated, that is to say, have the thing you're looking for in a pure form, then hopefully everybody, at least everybody who's willing to think, would agree that you can't do any studies of something that you don't have in a pure form. You can't say this part came from this thing unless you have the thing first. You can't say this thing does such and such unless you have isolated the thing from all other things and therefore have the means, the possibility of studying it. And one of the ways you can bring that point home is by using analogies, which is what I do tend to do a lot of. And I'm sure you can think of them. For instance, you can't know if there's a hammer in your toolbox and what it does and what it's made of, unless you take the hammer out of the toolbox and you have only the hammer, and then you can analyze what the hammer is made of and see if that hammer and the hammer alone knocks in the nail. Nobody would say that it's a proof if you ground up the entire toolbox and see what that's made of, or hit the nail with the entire toolbox to prove that hammers knock in nails. So the way I would start this conversation with any of the pro-virus people is to say, because the virus issue is so charged, let's just discuss how we isolate something else. So you could start with the hammer, and then you could go to the frog. And everybody knows you'd go to a pond where you suspect there is this organism called a frog. You would look for the frog. If you see something that meets the definition of a frog, you would take that, isolate it, means separate it from all other things. And then you could see what the frog does, if the frog catches flies, etc. If you're a mean person, you could actually kill the frog and dissect it and see what it's made of. And you could go through many, many examples of how that is exactly how we human beings study just about anything. Nobody would say that the definition of isolation of a frog would be to go to a pond and then dump a whole lot of ocean water and a whole lot of fresh water and a whole lot of tap water into the pond, sprinkle some algae and some fish in there, and then take a scoop and put that in a vat of flies and see if the flies die. And if the flies die, that means there's frogs that are eating flies. But I would actually put that example to any of the virus people and see if they agree that that is how you would isolate a frog. And maybe they'd say yes. And then I would say, but isn't that essentially exactly how they, quote, isolate the virus? They took unpurified pond water, otherwise known as bronchial fluid, mixed it with some other things, put it on something, see an effect, and call that isolation. Isn't that exactly what we just did with the frog? And yet, for some reason, nobody, I don't think, would say that that first example is how you isolate a frog. So why would you say this is how you isolate a virus? And see what they say. And go through example after example and finish with the question of, why is this the only thing I can think of? Because this happens, you could do this with nanoparticles. So this is not a size issue. I've talked to analytical chemists, and they have their techniques for separating out a nanoparticle from all the other things. They have it in a pure form. They then can assess what it's made of and what it does, if it does anything. So that process is obviously intuitive, logical, rational. It meets the criteria for scientific accuracy. Why is there one exception, which is this virus exception, that we have an entirely different process that we somehow also call isolation? So that's how I would proceed with the conversation. And what you have to do then is get very good, and this isn't easy for most people, is not moving off that topic or that example until you get agreement. And so if there is no agreement, then just go to another similar example, and I'm sure you could think of hundreds, and go through one after another, essentially wearing them down to say, isn't this what we mean by isolation? And isn't this not what we mean by isolation? And why, when we look at what you're claiming as isolation, we're doing exactly what you would say is not isolation. Why is there an example in this case? And they can give whatever excuse they want, but frankly, there is no excuse because that is not how any rational, logical, sane person would think. So I hope that helps. And now let's move on to the question of, is DNA what we think it is? And I've been over this a little bit, but today I'm going to do something that's a little bit different, and it may work and it may not work. But recently I was sent an article that was written on a website called Northern Tracy, T-R-A-C-E-Y. And I've looked a fair amount through the website, and I would say there are what I would call brilliant articles. And in fact, one of the most brilliant is the article that I'm going to mostly read, just because I think it's so important the way this person framed the questions and framed the responses. And so I'm going to go through the article, because I think everybody really needs to hear this. I hope everybody goes to the Northern Tracy website, and I don't even know the URL, I think you call it. And I'm just going to give a few comments, and I hope that works. It may be a little boring, but it's a fascinating article. It's a great way to take a look at this subject. They bring up a lot of questions. And just to say, I don't know who this person is. They say they're not a medical doctor, they're not a scientist, but they're a person who knows how to think, which is what it seems like to me. And frankly, I don't care if they're a medical doctor or a scientist. I care about the quality of their writing and their thinking and their questioning. And it's all about asking the right questions. And as you'll hopefully see, this was a brilliant description of how to ask the right questions and how to think about this subject. So again, I hope everybody checks it out, and I'm going to just go through this and see what we can find out. So there you see Northern Tracy's scribblings, I guess that's what they call it, and there's other articles and reviews, and you can contact, again, I don't know if it's even a him or a her. This was apparently somewhere between June 30th and July 25th, so I don't even know exactly when this was posted. But let's just read it as we go and see what we can find out. So mRNA is apparently the only new cure for all our ills. They're even giving this new era medicine, calling it the amino age. But is it all it's cracked up to be? I just heard, too, that anti-vaxxers are trendy now, which tells me they're ready to complete their big swap of vaccines for gene therapy. Problem, reaction, solution in full swing. The amino age is the offered solution, but is it a solution at all, or just another terrible healthcare paradigm to keep the slaves manageable and controlled? And so let me just comment, and that's how I'm going to do this. I think it's a very good point to say that people are more and more getting onto the vaccine scam, which is what I would call it. And so when that happens, the powers that, as they say, shouldn't be, tend to say, well, we can't keep going with this. So we're going to change the narrative. And the new narrative is we're going to solve your problems with so-called gene therapy or using our lofty information, the things that we know about DNA and RNA, and that's going to be the new thing. And hopefully, at least for them, they think it'll be a few years until we catch on to this and say how what nonsense this is. And all we're trying to do is shorten that few years and that we until we catch on to this nonsense to we don't even need to wait any days. We can see from the get-go that it's all just nonsense. So that's, I think, a good point. Are you confused by all this talk of messenger RNA, proteins, genes, genomes, DNA, and contagious disease? Well, you're not alone, and you are being confused on purpose. The way out of the confusion, I thought, was to dive in, swim around, and see what I can find that is solid and factual in all this science waffle being foisted on us. People with bits of paper to say they are qualified to tell us the facts are either lying or also confused. I spent 3 weeks looking into their papers and articles and methods and tests and gave myself a massive headache. I know what that feels like. It reminded me of the days I was trying to argue with shills over vaccines and what they did and did not do, which actually taught me a lot about their so-called science and how they confused people with their fancy language there too. All the technical stuff I learned about back then is just being rehashed and plonked onto what we were told about RNA and DNA. Just wrap the word virus for DNA, RNA, and you will see the same exaggerations, assumptions, and lies. I have to hit you with some big misconceptions which pull the rug from under the feet of modern medicine. This is a bit scary for some people, but I promise you the truth is far prettier than the convoluted, ugly theories we've been told. First, bombshell incoming. Lawsuit raises questions about DNA testing, race, and... All right. So some of the, like a lot of the subjects that we come into, when you ask people, well, how do you know that there's DNA and it does what they say? They say, well, what about the loss? What about, tracing your heredity? Or what about the legal use where they can find criminals or paternity suits, et cetera? So they bring up those issues. Now, again, just like virology, when they bring up, well, how do you explain chickenpox or mumps or herpes infection that I got from this whoever? And you say, well, how did they find the virus? What was the procedure? What were the methods used to prove that your DNA proves your paternity? And of course, just like in virology, 99% of the people, including almost all of the doctors, will have no clue how they did this. And I would emphasize to everybody that if you don't know the method of how they came to this conclusion, then you don't know anything about the subject, and you are ripe to be fooled, because they can tell you anything you want unless you know the method of how it was found. Okay. So we're going to take a look at some of the ways it was, or some of the things. What are they doing here? DNA, does it look like the pretty picture say it does? The theory of a blueprint in the nucleus of every cell. As I was trying to knit all this info into some semblance of cohesion, I suddenly wondered where the chromosomes were in all this. No one mentions them or what they are. So I looked them up. Supposedly, as DNA is wrapped up in the chromosomes in the nucleus of our cells, which have only ever been seen when the cells are dividing, only seen in embryonic cells, in other words, they see these chromosomes double and split into new cells as it divides into two. This process is called mitosis. DNA cannot be seen, though, and the very few photos of what we are told is DNA are very dodgy. Two I looked up have even been deleted from the internet, but I found them on the Wayback Machine. Why did they delete them? Probably because they look so fake, and sadly for them, look nothing like their cartoon DNA. So I looked up these pictures and here are the pictures she's referring to. So these are archived pictures of DNA imaged with electron microscope for the first time. You see that one on the left, and then you see another image of the DNA on the right. And as you can see, this one looks like a sort of weird egg crate, and this one just like a fuzzy line that could be a piece of thread or something like that. So this is not the spiral to heaven double helix that you see in all the pictures of the magazines and all the alternative books about how we're all made from this Jacob's ladder and spiral to heaven DNA. This is the best they got as to what this thing, this chemical, actually looks like. And she's quite right. This looks like nothing like what we're told. And so what gives? Okay, that's the first thing. She's also apparently a big fan of Stefan, which I think is for good reason, because Stefan Lenke is, if you're going to pay attention to anybody, what he says, Stefan's as good a place to start as any. So what did Lenke have to say about DNA and RNA back in the 90s? Quote, "I already had somewhat critical attitude when I started studying molecular genetics. So I went to the library to look up the literature on HIV. To my surprise, I found that when they are speaking about HIV, they're not speaking about a virus. They are speaking about cellular characteristics and activities of cells under very special conditions. I was wondering what viruses are for in evolution, because they didn't seem to have any function other than to be very dangerous in killing other cells. So I went into evolutionary biology and found that the first genetic molecule of life was RNA, and only later in evolution did DNA come into existence. Every one of our genomes and that of higher plants and animals is a product of so-called reverse transcription, RNA transcribed into DNA. And remember that when they discovered HIV, they used the fact that there was reverse transcriptase to prove that it was a retrovirus, because at that time they said only retroviruses transcribe RNA into DNA. And Stefan is saying that's not true. We now know that all normal cells, all repairing cells, do exactly that. So that couldn't possibly have been a proof of a new retrovirus. But I had already realized by then that the thinking about molecular genetics was very dogmatic. In the early 1960s, they came up with the central dogma of molecular genetics, which they try to uphold even today, which is ridiculous. The dogma says that DNA behaves in a static way. It doesn't change. DNA makes RNA. RNA cannot be transcribed back into DNA. RNA comes into existence only on the basis of DNA. That was and is the basis of the central dogma of molecular genetics. While studying the evolutionary aspects of biology, I quickly realized that reverse transcription is common to all forms of life and is in fact, is the basis of all higher living. Later, I learned that reverse transcription is a repair mechanism for chromosomal DNA, but the mainstream of molecular genetics is still committed to the central dogma. There is no such thing as reverse transcription from DNA to RNA. In 1970, when they detected biochemically that there is a reverse flow of genetic material, they didn't give up the dogma or even trying to change it. Instead, they called it an exception to the central dogma of molecular genetics and explained it by postulating the existence of retroviruses. So in other words, they made a mistake in thinking that there is no reverse transcription between RNA into DNA. So that was a mistake. And then when they found an exception to the mistake, they had to continue on their way of thinking, which led them to then hypothesize that the exception was because of the existence of these new forms of sort of life called retroviruses. And so hence came into existence the concept of retrovirus, which had no connection to any physical thing or any even physical process, because the process that they were ascribing it to, in fact, was not because of that supposedly new retrovirus. It was something that was common to all cells or all tissue. So you can see how a mistake in conceptualization actually led to the postulation of an entirely new category of organisms, which easily can be shown never existed because the conception that it was based on was incorrect. Okay, let's go on. We are told that our chromosomes, the genome, was mapped by a man called Morgan, but all I can find is work on plants and insects. How did he map the human chromosomes by looking at plants and insects? Again, this is another common mistake, where we were told that we're made of cells because Virchow apparently saw cells of an onion under a microscope. So somehow that proves that all living things are made of cells. You can see there's a lot of leaps of faith and assumptions in that conclusion. So they used classical genetics, as in looking at natural mutations like Mendel, a botanist, did with his peas, which all this stuff is based on. Peas with different colored flowers, inbreeding and crossbreeding. Chromosomes are like your sock drawer for keeping all those 6 feet of strings of DNA in some kind of order. But it's not just one string of DNA, because we have 23 paired chromosomes, making 46 in all. So that's a lot of blueprints, not just one. Oh, and guess what? We can see chromosomes under a normal microscope, but what they are and what they do is something else, because they are only ever seen during dividing cells, as in fetal cells. If that's the case, there are no proof they are in all cells, and Harold Hillman disputed this. In other words, since they're easy to see, you can see them under normal light microscopes, why don't you see them in all cells? Of course, the answer they give is they're made of these long strands of DNA, which are unfolded in the normal life of the cell and only go back into these containers called chromosomes during mitosis. But as I've explained many times, it turns out, as Dr. Nichols showed us, that DNA doesn't fit in those containers. So something is really wrong with that picture. So more recently, new pics are emerging saying they don't look anything like the pictures we've been sold again. The strands of DNA are supposed to be wrapped up in a globular mess somehow. Looks like they've been looking at bacterial chromosomes, or is it more debris? And now they're fighting over which ones are the real deal. And I won't show you these cartoon drawings, but the cartoon drawings of a chromosome look just like a picture of their proteins, like a lump of badly tangled wood. I can't help but say too, even though I might get blasted for it, that the original chromosomes look an awful lot like bacteria. There, I said it. Then I remembered this. In other words, they're pointing out that if you just look at it, these tangled up DNA look just like proteins, and the chromosomes look a lot like what we see as bacteria. So what do we make of this? From an old article I edited by a fellow independent researcher called "Is It Time to Give Up on the Flawed Modern Day Science of Genetics?" which I haven't read, they will not consider the fact that humans, animals, and plants have microbes that modulate their genes. Changes in the function of these genes also change animal and plant microbial makeup. Microbiota can alter host gene expression. These things have definitely not been considered by the biotech industry or the pharmaceutical industry. Something as simple as altering our diet can change our microbiome and alter gene expression in the body. So are the genes, the small strings of protein making recipes, really coming from our own cells, or are they from our bacteria? And that was one of the central interesting questions of this article, because that then starts to be able to help us to answering this question. What are they doing with genetic modification and GMO technology? What are they really doing? Since it's possible, as she's bringing up, that these chromosomes are actually just bacteria. So do our cells make the proteins from reading instructions from our own blueprint, or do the bacteria deliver them? Seeing as there is no proof whatsoever of our own cells doing this, and the fact they are using bacteria and yeast to produce synthetic proteins, it looks like it's all a lie, a mistake, or an assumption. All the work that I looked at it producing synthetic, quote, RNA/DNA seems to use bacteria and yeast to produce the product, which, by the way, a company called TriLink, who produce it, called it, the RNA, a drug. Funny description for something which is supposed to control our whole existence and heredity, i.e. calling it a drug. On the production end, I just saw mixing of chemicals, acids, and catalysts with yeast and bacteria, and then the usual poisoning and centrifuging, plus heating and cooling, till the end product pellets called synthetic RNA is left, and they call it a drug. This is what they call biochemistry. It's producing chemicals from biological processes. Or is it condensing living biology down to a chemical process, or a bit of both, just as they did with herbal medicines, plants, to turn them into patentable drugs? Just for clarification, we need to look up some of the things they talk about in these, quote, gene modification processes. RNA is said to be just strings of acids. In their CGI illustrations, they look like a half of string of DNA. How do they know it has a function? And how can you pass messages if it's just a string of chemicals, acids? And then the question, what are acids? The important point of this is, again, we always have to know what method did they use to produce this, say, insulin product, which they say is a product of genetic modification, synthetic DNA, RNA technology. In other words, they're claiming they take sequences and transfect them into different cells like bacteria or yeast, thereby forcing the bacteria or yeast to make this synthetic protein from this sequence that they added into it. But she's asking the question, isn't it true that the only living thing, therefore the only thing that could actually make a product or make a metabolic product, could have a result of its metabolism, is actually the bacteria or the fungus? So again, this isn't proof, but it's simply asking the question, is really what they're doing with GMO technology or making synthetic RNA is just altering the conditions that the bacteria and fungus are living in, the yeast and bacteria are living in, so that they make different products. And we figured out what conditions to alter, what acids, what catalysts, what chemicals, what different sequences to add to make these bacteria make a product that we may or may not want. And isn't it just bacteria that are actually doing this, not some genetic modification? And all they're doing is changing the conditions that the bacteria are living in. And so then there's a little bit about acids and alkaline, and then what is an amino acid? So what is an amino acid? Any chemical found in living tissues then, but then look what it says about protein too. So proteins are just a mixture of chemicals too. Well, in their eyes, they are. So the supposed spike protein is a bunch of chemicals mixed in a certain way, according to them. Sounds like a drug, doesn't it? Now maybe we can understand how they might seem to make them in a chemistry lab. There are so many scare stories coming out left and right about how much damage this spike protein could cause, and not only to those who take the shot, but maybe even those who are close to who haven't. So raking up the old contagion myth once again. We know viruses are a lie based on germ theory, another lie. But now we are made to believe proteins can suddenly spread disease person to person by, quote, shedding of a fictional protein, which they say they can force our own cells to produce at their bidding. But can they? They are mixing chemistry and mathematics and applying them to biological functions. This is the materialistic world these scientists live in. We are just breathing, walking chemical labs. We need to look at how the science of genetics has evolved, seeing as it is becoming the new dominant, quote, science in medicine. They brag about it replacing chemo and vaccines. Well, could it be any worse than chemo? Could it be any worse than vaccines? Probably not. Or is it just the same repackaged with more bells and lights? The processes in the lab looked like smoke and mirrors to me, all to hide the fact either they do not know what they are doing apart from chemical mixing, or they do know what they're doing, but they don't want us to know. Looks like the alchemy of old, which was very secretive, and the old science of the Freemasons. Let's have a look at the evolution of smoke and mirrors. So in other words, the point here is, and this is a bit like the Wizard of Oz story, they have you believe that they have this great wisdom that they only the elite know about, in this case, the elite scientists, and they can actually turn on your cells to make any chemical that they want or any protein they want, even though, as I've pointed out repeatedly, there's no evidence from assaying for these chemicals or these proteins that they can actually do that. And in fact, what they're doing in the lab is just simply using bacteria and putting them in different conditions, poisoning them, stressing them, different conditions so that they make different proteins. And they're somehow calling that hacking our DNA. And it's much more common and banal and less scary. And nobody should be doing any of this stuff anyways, because there's no reason to do it, et cetera. But it's not nearly as scary and obscure as we think. So classical genetics was a very slow process of damaging, poisoning, observing reactions, mutations, and earlier just inbreeding. Classical genetics looked for new mutations in plants, peas originally, and fruit flies because they reproduce very quickly. We all remember from our genetics courses, all the studies on stressing, poisoning, inbreeding peas and fruit flies and seeing what different forms they could come in. And we saw different forms. We said we got mutations. Nobody showed the mutations. They just showed that if you stress and poison plants and inbreed them in fruit flies, you get weird forms of plants and fruit flies. When they saw a mutation, they blamed the genes. Genetics was all about inheriting traits, but is morphed into genes causing changes in real time. Just like they blame germs and then viruses as scapegoats for chemical poisoning or malnutrition, they have gone now to the molecular levels of invisibility. So a plant grows with unusual features. Instead of asking what caused it to grow like this, they claim the reaction as the cause again. As with the TMV, they assumed it was something smaller than a germ, so a virus, when it was soil depletion, malnutrition, just as pleomorphism happens and bacteria morph to survive a hostile terrain. The morphism is not the cause, it is a symptom. The terrain is bad, everything has to adapt to its environment or perish. And so here we have a much different view of life and how life, quote, evolves. Life is infinitely flexible, or at least very flexible, let's say. I mean, you can't turn a pea into an elephant. But given certain conditions, given certain soil conditions and nutrition and environmental conditions, you will start to see the organism change. There's no reason to ascribe that to any mutations in any genes happening in real time. And this person comes to an example of how that is actually can be disproven. In the 90s, they went from classical genetics to technology and invented the microassays. Basically, they took the cell debris and put each bit robotically onto a chip arranged like thousands of jigsaw puzzles, just like you would spread them out to see before you start doing the jigsaw, except they claim to know what each bit of cell debris is, where it is placed. All very nice, but the reactions they claim are from specific genes were identified by classic genetics using observations of reactions to terrain anomalies and lots of guesswork. Now the assumptions have made have become colored dots produced by computers, robots, and chemical reactions, all programmed into computers from their old poisonings, observations, and guesswork. These assays were adopted from gene labs into virology lab, since they announced that viruses were bits of genetic material, so we can see how the two sciences were already crossing over. All the CGI pictures of DNA and talking about snipping and editing makes it sound very high-tech and mysterious. But do you know what they use to snip and join these supposed strings of acids? Bacteria. Apparently, E. coli is a fave tool for snipping at amino acid strings they call RNA, the same bacteria that dismantle proteins in dead tissue in our guts and also claim are very pathogenic. More proof that bacteria are indeed the janitors in our body, and they know it. In fact, it exposes they might even know more. They might even more than just janitors know more than just janitors, does it? In other words, this high-tech snipping and inserting genes is actually done by the only living thing in this mixture, which are bacteria, including E. coli, which actually are able to digest debris and recycle it and make their own metabolic products. And it's nothing more than feeding bacteria debris, which is exactly what they do in us. So let me skip down a little bit. Okay. They are claiming that CAS9 is a protein from a bacteria's immune system. That's interesting, isn't it? They claim that the bacteria produce proteins based on past experience of damaging chemicals, just like the story of our own immune systems do. So who is driving the immune system? Is it our cells or our bacteria? Can it be that the bacteria are not only our janitors, but they are, quote, our immune system, instead of being the enemy that our immune system was meant said to attack? This little nugget tells us that they knew all along that bacteria were helpers and not enemies. They clean up and recycle cell fragments, and they're trying to harness that. That is the whole point. That is exactly what they're doing with this genetic technology. They are harnessing bacteria to clean up and recycle cell fragments and chemicals. The problem is they only do this in our body with dead cells and debris. They do not harm or damage healthy cells. Remember, RNA, DNA is not a living substance, just like viruses are not. Are they trying to make this protein work for them on live tissue using, quote, gain of function? There's been a big hoo-ha about gain of function experiments, and we are led to believe they've been trying to make a virus. But what about this? No mention of viruses here. You can look up this study. Is the gain of function story a bending of the truth hidden in plain sight? Are they trying to make these proteins edit genes in live cells and live subjects, us, trying to genetically modify us under the guise of curing something? Remember what Lenka said about reverse transcription. There are lots of indications to tell us that they have been failing dismally in their efforts, though. They've also been hit with a public outcry. So then they go on to say let's read it. Did you know that back in 1974, all genetic experiments were banned because of public concern as to where this was leading? The genetic industry held a conference and declared to the world they'd been just trying to find cures for deadly diseases like cancer, and this was the only way. They were only allowed to resume work on the back of the massive promise, which was a lie. Now we have gone from banning their experiments on fetuses to all volunteering to be their human guinea pigs, and the world is their oyster. I found this story about using gene therapy in an 18-year-old, and it killed him. And so only in the last 5 years have human trials been allowed, and 2020 gives them their results. Is COVID the big human genetic engineering trial? Obviously, yes. We gave them permission to break all the rules back in 74 to allow them to continue. Is this why they needed an emergency to bend those rules? I think so, and that is why COVID was rolled out in the first place. But if you think this is the first time they've been using the technology, you'd be wrong. The first vaccine they produced in a gene lab was the Hep B, hailed as the first cancer vaccine, the very one that caused the disease AIDS, which Fauci and Mikovits were in on. The next one was HPV, which was their first attempt at curing cancer, except it didn't cure anything. They can't cure cancer because they know it's not a disease, so they plump for an unprovable prevention route, and that was their second attempt at a cancer vaccine with dire consequences again. Okay, let's regroup again and get back to cell debris. We are told that the mRNA is a short strand of genetic material which tells the cells how to mix all the amino acids to make a specific protein. If we have a blueprint, why do we need these smaller bits of information, and where do they come from? If they are just a strip of different chemicals, how do they do all the things they're claimed? From what they're claiming, it's like saying a strip of hair from my head can do double and triple salchos while cooking the dinner. They're discovering loads more supposedly different RNAs every day. Just add a letter or two for before RNA like M, for instance. The inside of a cell is starting to look like downtown Manhattan by the sounds of it, or are they simply looking at loads of cell debris from cells killed by their process in the lab and playing a weird guessing game at who can come up with the best story explaining what it might do? Here's another article that you can read. So guess what Panglossian means? Extreme optimism. Yes, it does look like science is fooling itself. Apart from everything they've seen of cells under total alien landscape of an electron microscope, these cells are always grown in tissue culture. Hillman pointed out that the cells in a tissue culture have, quote, significantly different morphology, biochemistry, and environment than the cells from which they came. Meaning, all in all, they might as well be looking at a lump of dog turd to describe the workings of a human cell. None of it can be believed because the fantastical story they have concocted goes against everything we see in nature, which is always simple and perfectly sensible. Hillman tried to stop this nonsensical storyline in the 70s, providing evidence that our model of the cell was completely incorrect, and used an old proverb as the intro in his book. Okay, let's skip down a little bit. Okay. In science labs working on genetics, the only biological ingredients they're using are bacteria and fungi. Remember, fungi and yeast are just another form of bacteria in the pleomorphic stage. They make genetics look very high tech of snipping and editing, but remember, bacteria recycle cell debris. They also produce enzymes, which are a type of protein, which cause the different amino acids which make up the proteins to break apart, just like they do in the digestive tract. From all this, we can deduce that RNA is as inanimate as DNA because it's just a string of acids. It doesn't do anything. The bacteria are doing all the work in the labs and in the cells. That's the most important part. They're just, I can't emphasize this enough, they're just harnessing the power of bacteria to make products and break apart cell debris and to trying to get them to make as specific products as they can. Other things I saw mentioned a lot in the gene lab work was something called plasmid. They tell us these are bacterial chromosomes. They use them as vectors to deliver drugs, RNA, into cells. The more I looked into these plasmids, the more convinced I became that they were talking about bacteriophages again. They base the whole of virology on these phages, remember. So plasmids are produced by bacteria and look like their description of a virus, and they contain some genetic material. Bingo. Plasmids are viruses, are bacteriophages, and let's go one step further because in the pleomorphic graph, which is the start and the end of bacterial morphology, the somatid, also called a microzyma by Beauchamp, it is immortal and contains all the information to start the whole process of life. I've hinted at what I think this RNA could be, but already somebody sent me a book and I translated this. It's very interesting. Bacteria are remarkable machine tools intended to dismantle old and sick cells, cancers, or scaffolds used to repair certain tissue injuries. In this sense, it is fundamental to understand that we do not get germs from the outside. There is no biological warfare, says Beauchamp. In an alkaline environment, microzymes assemble and manufacture bacteria. But if on the contrary, the environment of the body returns to a neutral pH, the bacteria disassembles and the microzymes recover, moving freely. Thus, depending on the bioelectric constants, temperature, presence or lack of oxygen, and nutritional substances in the living environment, microzymes communicate with each other to form a certain germ, mycelium, a mycobacteria that will be capable of fulfilling a certain mission. That line says everything we need to know, which is, we have these immortal primordial forms called microzyma, or here called microzymes. And depending on the conditions, they form different bacteria, they form different fungi, they do certain activities in the body, they dismantle old cells, cancer, They repair injuries, and they also have a metabolism which makes proteins. And that's what the entire genetic technology is basically harnessing, these essentially sick, distorted, chemically treated microcyma to make certain things that they want. They don't become serious unless important nutrients are missing. For example, in the case of tetanus, microcymas build tetanic bacilli in deep muscle injuries caused by wounds or burns in an anaerobic environment. Their mission is to evacuate damaged cells and rebuild new tissue. But this work requires energy and generates waste. In the absence of vitamin C, these wastes can become toxic and trigger the infamous the famous spasms of tetanus. That's a brilliant description of how disease comes about. It's been shown on several occasions that IV injections of magnesium chloride stops the spasm half an hour, or injection of vitamin C brings healing in 2 or 3 minutes. Microsomas are absolutely remarkable, considering they can transform into other living matter. They are complementary to each other, autonomous, specific, intelligent, and responsible. They always do what's best for the body. This is a very different view of biology and health and illness than the normal way. But for this, we need to provide them with the elements indispensable to their lives and their functioning: air, food, vitamin C, etc. Microlysis, for instance, E. coli, are capable of reproducing at very high speed in large numbers. They are not invaders or war aggressors. They feed and metabolize certain substances through a digestive mechanism. They need sugars, proteins, fatty materials, trace elements. They are living entities. They dismantle and remove waste. These entities made by microcymes can be dismantled to atomic chemical levels again. So when we were done using them, or when they're done doing their intelligent processes and cleanup devices, they get dismantled down to their constituent elements and into back down into their primordial microzyma to be used again for the next injury or imbalance. They are almost eternal, except for brutal destruction, soaking in formaldehyde. They can go into hibernation, partially dehydrated. Thus, microzymes were discovered in fossils 12 million years ago. They're specific to each individual and likely responsible for the transmission of hereditary characters. So there we have a new theory of how you look like your father, and how they can actually assay for these microcymes and find out if you're related. Somehow they're assaying for either the microcymes or products, etc. So I'm about out of time here. I just want to finish with one thing. And I hope everybody reads the rest of this so you can see more about all this. The only other thing I was wanted to say, and I don't know if I can find it here. So one of the things that was so striking to me is, when we say that mutations caused by, say, exogenous mutagens, they alter your DNA, and they become part of that altered DNA, becomes part of your permanent hereditary material. So that's what we're told. So a great example of this was the thalidomide disaster. So probably, I'm not sure the date, somewhere 50s or 60s maybe, a whole lot of pregnant women were given a nausea drug called thalidomide, and they ended up with having children with very specific so-called birth defects. And of course, the theory was that the thalidomide was a mutagen and that it caused a mutation in the tissues of the developing fetus. And this became their stable hereditary material. And that's this stable hereditary material had an abnormal expression, which is the phenotype, the abnormality that we see in these children. But the interesting thing about that story is those children with their altered genetic material were able to have perfectly normal children who apparently didn't pass that stable mutation down to their own children, which certainly seems to suggest that this was not because of a stable mutation, which then gets into the whole question of are the mutations the engine of evolution, which I doubt. But actually what happened is they simply poisoned the fetus, and that led to an abnormal expression of the fetus, which was the so-called birth defects that we see. There was nothing inherited about this. There was no stable change in anybody's DNA. It doesn't work like that. It's simply poisoning, starving, and recycling. And as you can see, and I hope everybody again reads the rest of this, that is the story of so-called modern technology genetics. And it's far less sophisticated and scary than we think. It's just good old-fashioned using the components of life, which are these sort of immortal forms, which Beauchamp, he essentially found, and many other people have found over 100 years ago. And they're simply using the characteristics of these to create products to poison us even further. And that's something that's easily understandable and therefore can be stopped, understood, and is far less scary than the stable hereditary changes that we're all led to believe. Okay, again, I hope everybody reads the rest of this. Check out their website, support their work, and I will see you next week.